Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 159. It's Monday, April 18th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, before we do the local COVID update, let's do a little context. First, this up from the New York Times. Many virus cases go uncounted. When the highly transmissible Omicron variant of the coronavirus arrived in the United States last fall, it pushed new case numbers to previously unseen peaks. Even then, the record wave of recorded infections was a significant undercount of reality. The official tally of coronavirus infection in the United States has always been an underestimate. But as Americans increasingly turn to at-home tests, states shutter mass testing sites, and institutions cut back on surveillance testing, case counts are becoming an increasingly unreliable measure of the virus's true toll, scientists say. It seems like the blind spots are getting worse with time, said Dennis Nash, an epidemiologist at the SUNY School of Public Health and Health Policy in New York City. The official case count can still pick up major trends and has begun to tick up again as BA2 spreads, but undercounts are likely to be a bigger problem in the weeks ahead, experts said, and mass testing sites and widespread surveillance testing may never return. By the time Omicron hit, a new challenge was presenting itself. At-home tests had finally become more widely available, and many Americans relied on them to get through the winter holidays. Many of those tests were never reported. We haven't done the groundwork to systematically capture those cases on a national level, said Caitlin Jadalina, an epidemiologist at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston. Some jurisdictions and test manufacturers have developed digital tools that allow people to report their test results, but one recent study suggests it may take work to get people to use them. Residents of six communities across the country were invited to use an app or an online platform to order free tests, log their results, and then, if they choose, send their data to their state health departments. Nearly 180,000 households used the digital assistant to order the test, but just 8% of those households of them logged in with any results on the platform. Researchers found that only three quarters of those reports were sent to health officials. So, actually, you had 8%, again, of households, not of individuals, but of households that logged any results. And only three quarters of that 8% sent results to health officials. So that's only 6% of households in these variety of studies. So clearly, a lot of tests are not being reported, those home tests. General COVID fatigue, as well as the protection that vaccination provides against severe symptoms, also may prompt fewer people to seek testing. And citing a lack of funds, the federal government recently announced that it would stop reimbursing healthcare providers for the cost of testing uninsured patients, prompting some providers to stop offering those tests for free. That could make uninsured Americans especially reluctant to test. The poorest neighborhoods will have even more depressed case numbers than higher income neighborhoods. Yep, folks, well, this is just a story of settling back into the old normal. The new normal looks, unfortunately, far too similar to the old normal and many of its deficiencies. Okay, well, and one more take on that underreporting this from my local epidemiologist. Taken together, we don't know the true discrepancy between reported case numbers and, quote, true case numbers in communities. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation estimates that for every 100 cases in the U.S., only 6 to 7 are officially recorded in our surveillance systems. For example, on March 31st, the Institute reported 27,400 cases, but estimated about 405,000 true cases due to an underreporting and asymptomatic infection. This gap was dramatically widened over time. During the peak Delta wave, an estimated 43% of cases were reported. During Omicron, about 26% of cases were recorded. Right now, an estimated 7% of cases are reported, which is abysmally low. We are flying blind. Okay, well, with that context, let's get to the local COVID-19 update, and we are seeing an increase of cases locally. In Lucas County, the average number of daily cases reported jumped up to 102 from 63 in the previous week. This makes Lucas County the hotspot in Ohio. Our rate is almost three times that higher, over three times higher that of the state rate and almost double the national rate. The testing positivity rates are definitely going up too. We've seen a reversal of trends in Lucas County. It was down to 2%, but is now reversed and is going back up to, and now is 2.3%. We're seeing even faster increases in Ohio and the U.S. In Ohio, the testing positivity rate is 3.7%, and in the United States as a whole, it's 4.6%, rising from 3.2% the week before. The state rate went up a full point over the most recent week as well. So definitely, where the trends have reversed. We also saw a slight reversal in nursing home active cases. We had 11 cases from one the previous week, seven the week before that. This is still pretty low historically, but again, a reversal of trends. That was 8 residents and 3 staff with active cases in long-term care facilities in Lucas County. Okay, University of Toledo, they had another small number, 4 identified cases in the most recent week reported. That's down from 13 the week before and 6 the week before and 5 the week before that. So low numbers relatively historically. New hospitalizations in Ohio have reversed their trend and they are now actually going up. This is the same trend for the U.S., only in the U.S. That trend is more slowly, but it looks like the new hospitalization rate has bottomed out in the U.S. and is going back up. Deaths nationally are down to about 500 per day, not exactly a low rate, and the rate of decline is slowing. That is leveling off somewhat. But this is in the range of dropping out of the third leading cause of death. Still far too many deaths from COVID. Okay, well, the feds are completely willing to reverse gears. This from Reuters. U.S. renews COVID-19 public health emergency. The United States last Wednesday renewed the COVID-19 public health emergency, allowing millions of Americans to keep getting free tests, vaccines, and treatments for at least 3 more months. This also allows additional reimbursement for like Medicare patients that get treated for COVID. So that's a good recognition in that from the feds that this is not over yet. But, of course, while that's happening, polling shows that Americans are pretty much over it. This from Axios. Most Americans say COVID is no longer a crisis. Less than 1 in 10 Americans now describe COVID-19 as a crisis, with about 3 in 4 calling it a manageable problem, and 1 in 6 saying it's no problem at all, according to the latest installment of the Axios Ipsos Coronavirus Index. The big picture? The latest wave of our national survey actually found a slight uptick in people's perceptions of the risks of certain activities, including flying, attending sports events, and returning to work, yet it shows the highest share of Americans visiting friends and family members outside the home and the lowest rate of social distancing since the early part of last summer. The number of respondents who said their employers are requiring them to wear masks dropped by nearly half over the past month, from 39% of employers down to 22%. 37% of respondents said they've already returned to their normal pre-COVID lives, a new survey high. Well, just as a reminder that prevention doesn't work and it's hard to notice things that don't happen, this from the Boston Globe. COVID-19 vaccines prevented more than 2.2 million U.S. deaths, study says. How much worse could the U.S. COVID-19 pandemic have been if vaccines hadn't arrived in the nick of time in December 2020? Unimaginably worse, according to a study released last week. The researchers estimated that vaccinations by the end of last month had averted more than 2.2 million deaths in the U.S., more than 17 million hospitalizations, and more than 66 million infections. Dr. Tom Friedan, former director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, reacted to the foundation report in a tweet saying, "Horrible as the toll of COVID has been, it could have been three times worse." And in some progress on the testing front, this from CBS News, FDA authorizes breath tests that can detect COVID-19 in 3 minutes. The FDA has granted emergency use authorization to a new COVID test that can detect infections with only a sample of a patient's breath, using a device that can yield results in less than 3 minutes. The test, designed for use in hospitals, doctor's offices, or mobile testing sites, requires a piece of equipment around the size of a piece of carry-on luggage. The FDA says the company will be able to produce around 100 instruments per week. Each test can evaluate around 160 samples every day. In a study of over 2,400 people with and without symptoms, the FDA says the device was able to spot over 91% of cases and yielded false positives in only 0.7% of results. Like with the rapid at-home COVID-19 test, the FDA says positive tests with the newly authorized breathalyzer should be confirmed with a molecular test that we commonly call PCR. Okay, well, in a slightly different type of disease surveillance story, this from the Detroit Free Press. Four Michiganders with COVID-19 strain unique to mink were likely first U.S. spillover cases from animals. Four Michiganders, a taxidermist, his wife, and two mink farm employees, were infected with a unique coronavirus strain connected to minks, leading Michigan health officials and the CDC to conclude they likely contracted the first known U.S. cases of so-called animal-to-human virus spillover. Michigan's four mink-connected COVID-19 cases, the only known animal-to-human cases in the U.S. to date, infected more people than was previously known. So this is new information. Almost 2 months later, a taxidermist in Eaton County also tested positive and showed the same two mutations in his sample's genetic sequence. He had no known links to the mink farm, suggesting he was likely infected in the community. A fourth person was also confirmed to have the same mutations in February of 21. The CDC constantly says mink transmission in humans is very rare, but we don't test. It's self-reported by mink producers, and mink producers don't want to report. There have been at least 18 known COVID-19 outbreaks among minks on mink farms in the U.S. out of an estimated 60 total farms in the country, 12 in Utah, 3 in Wisconsin, 1 in Oregon, 1 in Michigan, and 1 in an unidentified location, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The true number of outbreaks could be much higher if proper testing were conducted. Back to the old Trump axiom, if you don't test, you'll have less cases. Okay, well, next up, I want to do a series of stories that are not responding necessarily all that well to the ongoing challenges of maintaining or increasing our infrastructure to deal with various health problems. This first one from Politico. U.S. Global Vaccination Program employees look to leave over lack of funding. Dozens of USAID employees working to get COVID-19 vaccines in arms and strengthen health systems around the world are looking to leave the agency after Congress failed to provide additional funding for their programs, according to three people familiar with the matter. As employees look for new opportunities, the programs themselves are in flux while agency leaders consider consolidating COVID-19 programs at the United States Agency for International Development. Because more funding is in doubt, employees working on the global COVID response at USAID have begun telling agency partners they can no longer count on plans set for the future months. Goals set for later in the year are being either rethought or dropped, one of the people with knowledge of the matter said. And in supply chain capacity, this from Associated Press, efforts to make protective medical gear in the U.S. falling flat. Many companies that began producing personal protective equipment with patriotic optimism have scaled back, shut down, or given up, according to Associated Press analysis based on numerous interviews with manufacturers. Some already have sold equipment they bought with state government grants. As COVID-19 was stressing hospitals and shuttering businesses in 2020, elected officials touted the need to boost U.S. production of protective gear, All this stuff should be made in the United States and not in China, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said in remarks echoed by others. Yet many manufacturers who answered the call have faced logistical hurdles, regulatory rejections, slumping demand, and fierce competition from foreign suppliers. On April 1st, Florida-based American Surgical Mask Company became one of the latest to close. After the initial scramble for PPE subsided, many industry newcomers faced difficulty selling products. Government agencies sometimes wanted huge quantities at tough-to-meet deadlines. Hospital systems tended to contract with established suppliers. Retail sales waned after every virus surge. At the end of the day, when everybody said they wanted American-made, nobody's buying, not even the state, said Tony Blogamus, vice president of Green Resources Consulting, a rural Missouri firm that received an $800,000 state grant but has only sold a few thousand masks. We're kind of upset about the whole situation. The onset of the pandemic revealed that the U.S. was highly dependent on foreign countries for protective gear. When China limited exports because of its own battle against COVID-19, U.S. stockpiles plummeted. Prices skyrocketed as federal officials, governors, and healthcare systems competed for supplies. Though federal stockpiles have been replenished, shriveling domestic production has raised concerns that state governments, medical facilities, and others could again get stuck scrambling for gear during a future pandemic. Association organizers say the industry has reached a critical point. They want the federal government to treat PPE manufacturers like the nation's defense industry, entering into long-term contracts to perpetually replenish a stockpile for future pandemics or emergencies. If the federal government doesn't come in and help support the U.S. manufacturing base, it's almost certainly going to go back to China and will be just as vulnerable as we were in early 2020 and 2019, said Brent Dilley, the association chairman and co-founder of Premium PPE, a Virginia manufacturer started during the pandemic that has shed about two-thirds of its roughly 300 employees. The Biden administration also formed a task force of experts from federal agencies, healthcare providers, PPE manufacturers, and distributors to develop a national strategy for ensuring, quote, a resilient public health supply chain. Its work is expected to extend for years. Some manufacturers said they can't wait that long for a federal life preserver. And on the human resources front, this from the New York Times, state officials in the U.S. say they still have far too few epidemiologists, a CDC survey finds. Though the number of epidemiologists in state health departments surged during the pandemic, CDC reported that states were still far short of the public health workforces that officials say that they need. The report, based on a survey from early 2021 of state epidemiologists from all 50 states and the District of Columbia, reinforced broader concerns that public health workers across the country are less equipped to respond to a pandemic now than they were at the beginning of 2020. Even as the number of state epidemiologists grew, especially in fields like the COVID-19 response, staffing in general infectious disease, chronic diseases, and maternal and child health declined, the CDC said. Epidemiologists are responsible for tracking disease, developing responses, investigating health threats, and studying public health services and healthcare. And although the number of state epidemiologists grew by 23% from 2017 to 2021 to a total of over 4,000 positions, fewer states said in 2021 that they had the resources to fully monitor public health issues and to investigate and diagnose hazards that could affect people. In all, state officials said they needed another 2,200 epidemiologists to provide basic public health services, a survey found. You'll note that we need 50% more than what we already got. The CDC warned the public that public health needed predictable levels of funding over longer periods. Public health was often underfunded and neglected even before the pandemic. A combination of unpredictable funding, reduced authority to impose health orders, and staffing problems have made the work of state and local public health departments all the more difficult. Funding for epidemiology was fragile, the CDC reported. In 2021, epidemiology activities relied on federal money for 85% of their budgets, but states were unsure how long that money would last. 39% of that federal money was designated for COVID-19 work over limited time periods. And moving to healthcare infrastructure, here's an interesting story from WTOP. Survey indicates primary care physicians are planning exit. A national survey of primary care physicians paints a grim picture for the future of healthcare in the U.S. Fewer than a quarter of practices report being fully staffed. 36% of primary care clinicians felt burnout, an all-time high. One in four physicians plans to retire early in the next 3 years due to being overwhelmed by the pandemic. Nearly half of the surveyed clinicians, that's 46%, say primary care is crumbling. Maybe we should listen to our primary care doctors and do something about that. Okay, well, with public health and healthcare being under-resourced, as you move resources to one front, often other areas suffer. Here's an interesting story from Politico. COVID chaos fueled another public health crisis, STDs. 2+ years of pandemic isolation didn't lower the nation's record rates of sexually transmitted diseases. Instead, they got much worse. After an initial dip when the pandemic began in the spring of 2020, cases of gonorrhea and syphilis surged, reaching new highs by the end of the year, according to preliminary data from the CDC. Progress on HIV has also slowed significantly. Public health experts expect that when the CDC releases 2021 numbers later this year, they will also show that COVID-19 made a bad situation exponentially worse as clinics closed, people lost health insurance, and risky behavior surged. Now, as COVID cases decline, public health experts are calling for new investments, including more money for STD testing and treatment, in an effort to reverse the increases. But a boost in public health spending is stalled in Congress, and Obamacare opponents are asking a federal judge to overturn a part of the law that requires the kind of free preventive care that can avert STDs. Sexual health experts and government officials are warning that without federal action, millions of Americans could face severe, even fatal consequences if infections go untested and untreated, with the burden of disease disproportionately falling on low-income Americans, young people, and people of color. Unfortunately, all signs indicate that the numbers are getting worse and that they're not going to get better until we adopt some new approaches and invest further in STD and public health programs, said Dave Harvey, the executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors. We have a lot of work to get back to where we were pre-pandemic. According to the most recent federal data, nearly 68 million people have an STD. Nearly half of those people are between the ages of 15 and 24. Black people and LGBTQ people also have disproportionately high rates of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, disparities that federal officials say are caused by differences in access to health care, not behavior. Some innovations spurred by the pandemic have helped, although access to them might end when the COVID emergency eventually does. For example, more people who live far from a provider could use telehealth for the first time to diagnose and manage many STDs, and more cities and states have started mailing people free at-home test kits for HIV and common STDs. But experts say progress with these tools hasn't made up for the massive disruption of routine screening caused by COVID. While people suffering symptoms from an STD are still seeking testing and treatment, many more are likely walking around with an asymptomatic infection that could spread to others. Most women who contract gonorrhea, for example, don't experience any symptoms, while chlamydia is asymptomatic for as much as half of men and 80% of women. Efforts to lower HIV rates, the nation's one success story in recent years when it comes to STDs, have also been hampered by COVID. The CDC estimates that around 1.2 million people in the U.S. are at risk of contracting HIV and would benefit from taking the pill PrEP, which can help prevent the infection. The agency announced a goal in 2019 to have 50% of those at risk taking the pills by 2030. The country at the time seemed on track with about 22% of the population taking the drug. Then the pandemic hit. Given the steep decline in condom use over the past decade and a half, public health experts say the drug is needed more now than ever to prevent people from contracting HIV, even as some studies have found that people who take the pills have higher STD rates because they are less likely to take other precautions. Okay, well, in slightly better news in the wake of the pandemic, this from the Associated Press, U.S. adult smoking rate fell during the first year of the pandemic. The first year of the COVID-19 pandemic saw more Americans drinking heavily or using illicit drugs, but apparently not smoking. U.S. cigarette smoking dropped to an all-time low in 2020, with 1 in 8 adults saying they were current smokers, according to the survey data released by the CDC. Adult e-cigarette use also dropped, the CDC reported. CDC officials credited public health campaigns and policies for the decline, but outside experts said tobacco company price hikes and pandemic lifestyle changes likely played roles. People who were mainly social smokers just didn't have that going on anymore, said Megan Roberts, an Ohio State University researcher focused on tobacco product use among young adults and adolescents. What's more, parents who suddenly were home with their kids full-time may have cut back, and some people may have quit following reports that smokers were more likely to develop severe illness after a coronavirus infection. The CDC report, based on a survey of more than 31,000 U.S. adults, found that 19% of Americans used at least one tobacco product in 2020, down from about 21% in 2019. Cigarettes were the most commonly used tobacco product, with 12.5% of adults using them, down from 14%. Health officials have long considered cigarette smoking, a risk factor for lung cancer, heart disease, and stroke, to be the leading cause of preventable death in the United States. In 1965, 42% of U.S. adults were smokers. The rate has been gradually dropping for decades for a number of reasons, including taxes and smoking bans in workplaces and restaurants. But a big part of the recent decline has to be recent price hikes, some experts said. Interestingly, the number of cigarettes sold in the U.S. actually went up in 2020, the first such increase in two decades, the Federal Trade Commission reported last year. It's possible that fewer people smoked, but those who did were consuming more cigarettes. That's a viable hypothesis, that you had people with more smoking opportunities because they weren't going to work, said University of Ottawa's David Sweener, a global tobacco policy expert at the University of Ottawa. Well, folks, if you are a smoker or know someone who's a smoker who's interested in quitting, you can call the Ohio Quit Line for free help and access to resources. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. 1-800-QUIT-NOW. You're listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. I am broadcasting from the John Snow Memorial Studio. Okay, well, next up we have a fresh perspective on healthcare access from Stat News. Human Rights Watch says unaffordable U.S. insulin is a human rights abuse. Insulin prices are sky high. High enough now that Human Rights Watch is declaring that insulin price tags contribute to human rights abuse. The international advocacy organization, best known for investigating war crimes, genocides, and dictatorships, is out with a new report that argues that the human rights of people with diabetes are being violated when they're unable to afford their insulin. That makes insulin makers who set those high prices complicit in human rights abuses, according to Matt McConnell, the lead author. The declaration casts a harsh new spotlight on the industry. While the top three insulin makers, Sanofi, Eli Lilly, and Novo Nordisk, have been the subject of multiple congressional investigations, class action lawsuits, and even protests from the families of loved ones who have died because of insulin rationing, they've never been called out as human rights abusers by an organization with the reach and power of Human Rights Watch. If they can continue with this line of attack, it's going to be really hard for the pharmaceutical companies to deflect this criticism, says Pallavi Kumar, professor of communication at American University, who previously worked in communications at Wyeth Pharmaceuticals. This is coming from Human Rights Watch. It's coming from an organization whose whole mission is to protect human rights. For them to tackle this issue, that's pretty big. Though the Human Rights Watch assessment faults drug makers, the text of the report actually places a lion's share of the blame on the U.S. government. It has the ultimate responsibility to make sure its citizens have access to essential medicines, McConnell said. The U.S. government has abdicated its obligation to ensure equal and affordable access to essential medicines, the report states. The government's lack of action may even violate two international human rights treaties, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, the report continues. The accusations from Human Rights Watch come as Congress scrambles to address insulin affordability ahead of the November midterm elections. House lawmakers recently passed legislation that would cap what people with Medicare can pay for insulin each month. Lawmakers are also readying a separate bill that would offer incentives for drug makers to lower their list price for insulin. Even that may not be enough to satisfy Human Rights Watch. McConnell argued that the so-called copay cap is not a comprehensive enough solution. Instead, Human Rights Watch argues that Congress needs to take on drug makers' power to raise their prices. The report endorses a number of drug pricing proposals, like post-approval price controls, that would determine how much drug makers can charge for insulin, as well as legislation that would limit how much drug makers can increase their prices over time. The report also suggests legislation to provide insulin to all insulin-dependent individuals in the country free of cost. Well, that's a novel idea. But, of course, for-profit healthcare sets up a huge bunch of perverse incentives in our healthcare system. Here's just an example of one of those, this from Axios. Whistleblower explains how Medicare Advantage plan bilked millions. Major Medicare plans are often inflating how sick their members are, and at least one example went so far as to add diagnoses doctors hadn't made to bilk millions of dollars from the healthcare system, a whistleblower told Bloomberg. Why it matters. Medicare Advantage is fast growing in popularity, and in the amount of money it's costing the healthcare system as seniors flock to the plans. Health insurers that sell private Medicare plans collect $12 billion more caring for seniors in 2020 than it would have cost traditional Medicare to do the same. A report from the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission attributed the difference to aggressive medical record coding. So, can we overcome our addiction to for-profit healthcare?
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, I have a very interesting story on a major link of a driver for prejudice and racism. This from Science Daily. Disbelief in human evolution linked to greater prejudice and racism. A disbelief in human evolution was associated with higher levels of prejudice, racist attitudes in support of discriminatory behavior against blacks, immigrants, and the LGBTQ community in the U.S., according to University of Massachusetts Amherst research in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Similarly, across the globe, in 19 Eastern European countries, 25 Muslim countries, and in Israel, low belief in evolution was linked to higher biases within a person's group, prejudicial attitudes towards people in different groups, and less support for conflict resolution. People who perceive themselves as more similar to animals are also people who tend to have more pro-social or positive attitudes towards out-group members or people from stigmatized and marginalized backgrounds. Yeah, kind of makes you wonder, who are the real animals in all of this? In this investigation, we were interested in examining whether belief in evolution would also act in a similar way, because it would reinforce this belief that we were more similar to animals. In 8 studies involving different areas in the world, the researchers analyzed data from the American General Social Survey, the Pew Research Center, and 3 online crowdsorted samples. In testing their hypothesis about the association of different levels of belief in evolution, they accounted for education, political ideology, religiosity, cultural identity, and scientific knowledge. We found the same results each time, which is basically that believing in evolution relates to less prejudice, regardless of the group you're in, and controlling for all these alternative explanations. For example, religious beliefs like political ideology were measured separately from a belief or disbelief in evolution, the researchers note. Regardless of whether one considers religion an important part of their life, belief in evolution relates to less prejudice independently from belief or lack thereof in God or any particular religion. This whole effect and pattern seems to be present in all major political systems. It's very much a human phenomenon, no matter where you are in the world. The researchers note that Darwin's 19th century theory of evolution has been cited to perpetuate racism, prejudice, and homophobia, in part through the phrase survival of the fittest, used to describe the process of natural selection. There have been theoretical accounts that predict the opposite of what we found, so it was exciting for us to show that this actually is not the case, and that the opposite is true, and that belief in evolution seems to have pretty positive effects. The data analysis shows unfailingly that the disbelief in human evolution is the driving factor and most consistent predictor of prejudice in comparison to other relevant constructs, the paper states. The researchers posit that a belief in evolution may expand people's, quote, moral circle, leading to a sense that we have more in common, that we have more in common than things that are different. Amen. Okay, well, returning back to America for a little drill down into racism in America, this from the Associated Press. National Urban League finds state of Black America is grim. The National Urban League released its annual report on the state of Black America, and its findings are grim. This year's Equality Index show Black people are still only get only 74% of the American pie that white people enjoy. While Black people have made economic and health gains, they've slipped further behind white people in education, social justice, and civic engagement since this index was launched in 2005. A compendium of average outcomes by race in many aspects of life shows just how hard it is for people of color to overcome systemic racism, the Civil Rights Organization says. Among dozens of health measures, one stands out. Life expectancy has declined slightly for African Americans, so a Black child born today can expect to live 74.7 years, 4 years less than a white baby. And lifelong inequities loom. Black women are 59% more likely to die as a result of bearing a child, and 31% more likely to die of breast cancer. Black men are 52% more likely to die of prostate cancer. Overdoses afflict the races about equally, while white people are 55% more likely to drink themselves to death through cirrhosis or chronic liver disease. Among people 15 to 24, white people are more than twice as likely to kill themselves, while Black men are 9 times more likely to die by homicide. Educational gaps abound. Black and white preschoolers are roughly equally prepared, but the classrooms they enter are starkly different. Schools with more minority students are more likely to have inexperienced, less trained, and even uncertified teachers. Fewer of these students are enrolled in the STEM classes that can lead to higher paying jobs. Black students are less likely to graduate from college. The index uses U.S. Justice Department statistics to chart social justice differences, noting that Black people have been more than twice as likely as white people to experience threats or uses of force during police encounters, and 3 times more likely to be jailed if arrested. In 2020, they were 93% more likely to be victims of hate crimes. Okay, well, switching gears a bit and going back globally, this from Medical Express. Americans report mental health effects of climate change, worry about future. According to the latest Healthy Minds monthly poll from the American Psychiatric Association, 58% of adults believe climate change is already impacting the health of Americans, and nearly half, 48%, agree that it's impacting the mental health of Americans. Half of adults are anxious about climate change impact on future generations. In a nationally representative sample, more were worried about the impact of climate change on the planet, 55%, than on their own mental health, 39%. They were split on how news about climate change affected their mood, with 42% saying it affected them some or a lot, and 43% not much or not at all. Young people were more anxious about climate change. Of those aged 18 to 34, 66% were anxious about its effect on the planet. 51% were worried about its impact on their mental health. 59% worried about its impact on future generations. They were also more likely to believe it was already having an effect on their health, 64%, and mental health, 57% of Americans. Climate change is a public health emergency, and we can't neglect mental health when we call it out. The American Psychiatric Association Committee on Climate Change Chair, Dr. Elizabeth Haas, our care for the planet is our care for ourselves, and by taking action, we help ourselves with its mental health effects. White people were the least likely to report anxiety over the impact of climate change on the planet at 52% versus Hispanics at 62% and Black folks at 65% or people of other ethnicities at 66%. Among those polled, 53% believe climate change is caused by human activity, 16% believe the cause is not yet determined, 13% believe it's caused by something other than human activity, 8% don't believe in climate change, and believe it or not, 11% had no opinion. Okay, next up, a story on children with disabilities experiencing violence. This from Medical Express. 1 in 3 children with disabilities globally have experienced violence in their lifetimes. Children and adolescents, those age 18 years and younger, with disability experience physical, sexual, and emotional violence and neglect at considerably higher rates than those without disability, despite advances in awareness and policy in recent years. According to a systematic review and meta-analysis of studies involving more than 16 million young people from 25 countries conducted between 1990 and 2020, the study was published in the Lancet Child and Adolescent Health Journal. Young people with mental illness and cognitive or learning disabilities, such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and autism, are especially likely to experience violence. And overall, children with disabilities are more than twice as likely to experience violence compared to those without disabilities, which can have serious and long-lasting impact on their health and well-being. And next up, a story regarding screening for anxiety in kids. This from MedPage Today. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force says screen kids 8 and up for anxiety. In new draft guidelines, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force for the first time recommends that healthcare providers screen children for anxiety, regardless of whether they are showing signs and symptoms. The task force is recommending anxiety screening for children 8 and older and reaffirmed their recommendation to screen for major depression in adolescents aged 12 and up, citing a moderate net benefit for these age groups. Too many children and teens in the United States experience mental health conditions, including anxiety, depression, and suicidal thoughts or behaviors, the task force wrote in a press release. For older children and teens, screening and follow-up care can reduce symptoms of depression and can improve and potentially resolve anxiety. While the recommendations apply in the absence of signs or symptoms of these conditions, the group noted that anyone expressing concern or showing symptoms should be connected to care. The group is not recommending screening for anxiety and depression in younger children due to a lack of evidence. In addition, despite the task force acknowledging in its statement that suicide is tragically a leading cause of death for older children and teens, they could not recommend for or against screening for suicide risk in children of any age, again, due to insufficient evidence. More research on these important conditions is critical, said task force member Lori Pibert of the University of Massachusetts Medical School. In the meantime, healthcare professionals should use their clinical judgment based on individual patient circumstances when deciding whether or not to screen. While screening for major depressive disorder is recommended in all adolescents, risk factors include a personal or family history of depression, childhood abuse or neglect, exposure to traumatic events, bullying, either as perpetrators or as victims, adverse life events, early exposure to stress, maltreatment, and an insecure parental relationship. Some of the risk factors for childhood anxiety disorders include attachment difficulties, parental conflict or early separation, overprotection, and maltreatment. LGBTQ youth are at significantly increased risk for anxiety. And another story for young people and mental health, this from Medical Express. Rising parental expectations linked to perfectionism in college students. Rising parental expectations and criticism are linked to an increase in perfectionism among college students, which can have damaging mental health consequences, according to new research published by the American Psychological Association. Researchers analyzed data from more than 20,000 American, Canadian, and British college students. They found that young people's perceptions of their parents' expectations and criticisms have increased over the past 32 years and are linked to an increase in their perfectionism. Perfectionism contributes to many psychological conditions, including depression, anxiety, self-harm, and eating disorders, said lead researcher Thomas Curran, an assistant professor of psychological and behavioral science at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Study co-author Andrew Hill, professor of sports and exercise psychology at York St. John's University, added, "The pressure to conform to perfect ideals has never been greater and could be the basis for an impending public health issue." Perfectionism often becomes a lifelong trait, and prior research has shown that perfectionists become more neurotic and less conscientious as they get older. Perfectionism can also perpetuate through generations, with perfectionist parents raising perfectionist children. Curran and Hill previously found that perfectionism was increasing among young people in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. They suspected that one cause might be that parents are becoming more anxious and controlling. One of their findings? Parental expectations may be more damaging than parental criticism. These trends may help explain increasing mental health issues in young people and suggest that this problem will only worsen in the future. It's normal for parents to be anxious about their children, but increasingly this anxiety is being interpreted as pressure to be perfect. The rate of increase in young people's perceptions of their parents' expectations is remarkable, up an average 40% compared with 1989. Parents are placing excessive expectations on their children because they think, correctly, that society demands it or their children will fall down the social ladder. It's ultimately not about parents recalibrating their expectations. It's about society, our economy, education system, and supposed meritocracy, recognizing that the pressures we're putting on young people and their families are unnecessarily overwhelming. Parents can help their children navigate societal pressures in a healthy way by teaching that failure or imperfection is a normal and natural part of life. Focusing on learning and development, not test scores or social media, helps children develop healthy self-esteem, which doesn't depend on others' validation or external metrics. Okay, well, next up, I have a story about the epidemic of drug overdoses among teens. This is from Stat News. Driven by fentanyl, rates of fatal teen overdoses doubled in 2020. After staying flat for a decade, the overdose death rate among U.S. adolescents nearly doubled from 2019 to 2020, an alarming climb that continued into 2021. The reasons do not include a surge of children in this group, age 14 to 18, using drugs, researchers said. If anything, survey data indicate that fewer teens experimented with drugs during the pandemic. Rather, a main factor is that the supply of increasingly deadly drugs has trickled into what adolescents are using. What teens may think is an opioid painkiller or Xanax diverted from a legal supply is now more likely to be a counterfeit tablet containing fentanyl or similar synthetic opioids. Drug use is becoming more dangerous, not more common, among adolescents, said Joseph Friedman, a UCLA addiction researcher and lead author of the paper. In 2020, 954 adolescents fatally overdosed, a rate of 4.6 per 100,000. For the first 6 months of 2021, their rate increased another 20% to 5.5 per 100,000. As of 2021, the overdose death rate for the entire population was 31 per 100,000. So while it's increased rapidly among teens, it is important to recognize that the teen overdose rate is only a fifth of that of the general population. But of course, a rate of increase is something you want to pay attention to. Okay, well, want to switch gears a lot and move to gut health. This from Medical Express. Microbiome experts warn of an invisible extinction that's harming human health. When Maria Gloria Domingo Bello travels to the Amazon jungle and tells villagers a reason for her visit, their first response is often laughter. Did you come all this way just to see my poop? They asked. She did, no humor intended, and she has been doing it for more than 20 years. She and her husband, Martin Blazer, both scientists at Rutgers University, are the stars of a new documentary called Invisible Extinction, describing their years of research on how modern diet and medicine are disrupting our internal colonies of bacteria and other microbes, the human microbiome. The microbiome has been a hot topic for well over a decade, as they and other researchers continue to identify connections between the loss of good bacteria in a variety of human diseases, such as obesity, certain cancers, and autoimmune disorders. Yet the science of how to reverse these problems remains in its infancy. That's the message that the Rutgers couple hopes to convey in the film, which premiered at a Copenhagen Film Festival recently. They are racing to identify which kinds of bacteria are essential to human health and how they might be restored through the use of targeted probiotics and other treatments. The couple think the fecal samples from the Amazon are a big part of the solution, as they are teeming with microbes that have yet to be altered by antibiotics or sugary, low-fiber Western diets. We seek answers in places where the problem hasn't yet begun, she says. No screening of the documentary has been scheduled yet in the U.S., but the filmmakers are on the hunt for a streaming service. More information in a movie trailer can be seen at theinvisibleextinction.com. That's theinvisibleextinction.com. In the meantime, the Rutgers scientists are helping to create the microbiota vault, a secure sub-zero repository to preserve the full richness of the microbiome, including species found in the oral and fecal samples from the Amazon. One day, he said, we will probably be giving back bacteria to children just to restore the ancient organisms that have been lost. In their research, the Rutgers couple explored how a variety of modern practices can alter the microbiome, such as diet, the overuse of antibiotics, delivering babies by C-section, and the use of infant formula in lieu of breastfeeding. The answer, they say, is not to reject drugs, C-sections, and other elements of modern society, as they can all save lives. The key is to use them only when appropriate, so as to minimize collateral damage to the microbiome. When antibiotics are overused, for example, not only do the drugs wipe out beneficial bacteria, along with the disease-causing pathogens for which they are designed, they also clear the way for any drug-resistant microbes to take hold. Restoring one's microbial diversity is harder than it sounds. One option is a fecal transplant. Another option is the oral supplements called probiotics, yet more work is needed there too, as many current products are more about marketing than scientific substance. I would add again, I think the most underreported aspect of this microbiome is actually prebiotics. When they talk about a low-fiber Western diet, high in sugar, and all this kind of stuff, that's basically saying that because you don't have whole foods in your diet, you're not providing the bacteria in your gut the proper nutrients, ecosystem, if you will, for these healthy, good bacteria to thrive and survive. So really, you can bring back and seed a small number of species by doing probiotic supplements and by eating like fermented foods and stuff can give you a broader range of bacteria, kind of reintroduce them, kind of kick them up a little, give them a little kick up in your diet. But ultimately, it's trying to plant like a banana tree in Alaska. If you don't have the right ecosystem, you can plant as many banana trees as you want in Alaska. They're not going to grow. And it's the same way with their microbiome. If you're not providing your gut the food it needs for these good bacteria to survive, ultimately, you're not going to get a lot of them. So the ecology depends on the food of that environment. So you're not only feeding yourself, you're feeding the gut in your bacteria, and it can make a big difference on our health. Okay, well, sort of on the getting back to nature theme here, I wanted to do a story on home gardening trends. This from GardenPals.com. Home gardening is booming worldwide, but the trend was positive long before the pandemic. Gardening is a soothing hobby for the whole family, a great way to get exercise and improve self-sufficiency, which is critical during this difficult period. Highlights of statistics on gardening. 42% of gardeners spent more time gardening during the COVID pandemic. Global online sales of gardening goods doubled during the COVID pandemic. 55% of American households engage in gardening activities. And the average garden yields $600 worth of produce in a year. That's with only a typical investment of $70. So that would be a net yield of $530 worth of produce in a year. Way to go, gardeners. One in three households in the U.S. is growing food. And last little tip, children involved in growing vegetables are more willing to eat them. So if you haven't already planted a garden, start one. You can actually start in your own house in a pot. You can make your existing garden bigger. You can grow different things. Plenty of things to do for gardening. Good for our health in many ways and good for our planet. Okay, well, that does it for the regular stories in this episode. But I do have some bonus articles. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, all available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give a link at the end of the list. Have 9 bonus articles this week. First up, 1. Is COVID more dangerous than driving? How scientists are parsing COVID risks. Another attempt to try to figure out risks, and this is an interesting other little take. One of the conclusions they had that if we're trying to protect immunocompromised people, we have to get the level of COVID down even lower. This relates to like mask mandates and that type of thing. Okay, 2, a tale of many pandemics. In year 3, it's a matter of status and access. So this is a story as old as time in public health. That actually, when you have a pandemic, it's usually multiple pandemics. It's experienced differently in different populations. And obviously, vulnerable populations, by the very definition, are more vulnerable. So it depends a lot on status and access, how you're experiencing this pandemic. Okay, three, the unbelievable stupidity of ending global COVID aid. This is the planet shooting itself in the foot. Four, after accusations of structural racism at the Journal of the American Medical Association, a black health equity advocate is named the journal's editor. Woohoo! Way to go. So this is a follow-up. I've reported on this structural racism at JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, before. So it's nice to see that we're getting some good feedback here and getting a black health equity advocate as the journal's editor. Okay, five. More than half of clinical trials do not report race ethnicity data. This was looking over like a 20-year period, and while less than half over that period reported any kind of race or ethnicity data, a real problem. It actually did go up quite a bit over time, particularly in more recent years. So some progress is being made on the good side of that news. Six, experts warn that patient influencers are being paid by big pharma companies to hawk drugs to U.S. consumers without telling them. This is one way that pharmaceutical companies can get around all the requirements for like TV ads, you know, all that small print and all those list of side effects and stuff, if they can pay secretly patient influencers to plug their products. You know, they can promote it without having to talk about bad side effects and that type of thing. By the way, this is actually illegal, but doesn't mean that it's not happening. Seven, where do U.S. opioid trial settlements stand? So there's a lot of these going on. Some have been settled. Many of them are still open. So if you want to catch up on that, that's a good article. Eight, very interesting article, decreasing sex crimes with therapy and friendship. So this I would call is a little more non-traditional, perhaps radical approach to dealing with sex offenders, since being a sex offender is one of the most stigmatized and socially isolating social conditions you can have. Offering people therapy and friendship is one way to mitigate the kind of isolation that can just lead to reoffense. So this is good for both the larger community and preventing reoffending, but it's also just a humane thing to do for sex offenders who suffer a lot of the effects of their own offenses. Okay, and nine, but not least, hopefully a practical one you can use. How do I improve my motivation to exercise when I really hate it? 10 science-based backed tips. Okay, well, you can read these and all the other stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-